Hello and welcome to the Wave Pool Mag podcast. My name is Brian Dickerson. Today, my very special guest is Nick Robinson, who used to host this very own podcast. And we've come full circle and here we are. Nick, how are you doing?
Great. It feels weird being on the other side.
You are on the other side. And I remember years ago, you approached me. I got an email from this crazy South African guy who wanted to do a podcast for Wave Pool Mag. And I said, yeah, sure, let's try it. And it was you, and you put in quite a few good years there.
Yeah, it was an exciting time. I remember it was really interesting because at the same time, I was starting plans and dreams to create a wave pool here in Portugal. And I just felt that, you know, I was looking around the internet, obviously I did a lot of research and Wave Pool Mag kept on coming up again and again and again. I was like, wow, this guy's got something going on. So I remember reaching out to you and you were like, what, you want to do what? you want to run my podcast for me? I think it was a bit of a scary thought for you. And how did that feel?
That was great. And that's how Wave Pool Mag has grown very organically, because we've had everyone who's approached us with ideas like yours, Sarah Beardmore, who did our app, and some other people in there. They've just reached out to us saying they're really excited about the space and they want to contribute in some capacity. And we're a very welcoming platform for that.
So, no, I suppose when you do something,
it wasn't
well,
that odd at all.
What? Yeah, I suppose when you do something well, then people gravitate towards it. So it's a testament to what you've put into it, Brian. It's amazing. Yeah. Well done.
Thanks. And what we're keeping on through the podcast is, I guess you had started it originally to have information and to research for yourself, to find out information about what exactly you need to do to complete a wave pool project. You had your project going in Portugal, and that's the reason I wanted to have you on the show today, is so you can share your experiences with our listeners, because many of the listeners out there are going through the exact same thing that you went through and are possibly still going through. So, Nick, maybe you can give us a little background, like what gave you the idea? What year was that? I know you went to Wave Garden in the early days, and what kind of planted the seed and how did it all start?
Sure. Well, just a little proviso in the beginning is like, I'm not operating a wave pool right now. So this is a story about failure, what not to do. But it was an interesting ride and it really was. And hopefully it'll be helpful to a lot of people. So I'm quite happy to share it. We started, actually, it was in 2018, in the summer of 2018, because I live down here in Portugal, in the Algarve, and we were cooling off around the pool. And I said to a couple of my buddies, one guy is in real estate, he was quite a top-end luxury real estate guy, sells these million-dollar houses, you know what I mean, or million-euro houses. And I said to him, I'm thinking about these wave pools. I think they're amazing. They're really incredible technologies that they're coming up with. You know, I'd love to build one. And the guy said, well, why don't you? I said, well, who am I? I've got no experience in this at all. It's essentially a real estate deal. And I'm not a real estate agent. I don't know anything about it. I just love to surf. And I love the technology. And he said, doesn't matter, man. Just go and do it. And I did. I was like, wow. And I was constantly battling with sort of imposter syndrome all the time, thinking, who the hell am I? And I think that all the major tech companies deal with this a lot as well. It's like they have to evaluate all these guys who are knocking on their door saying, well, are they tire kickers? Are they real? Are they not? Because our first goal was obviously to learn about the technology. And I'd heard about this guy also called Nick in Bristol, and Nick Hounsfield. And he obviously turned out to be hugely successful in the space and they launched the second wave pool in the world, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, the wave opened right around when Urban Surf did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, almost exactly the same time. So I messaged Nick Hounsfield on LinkedIn. And after a couple of hits, he came back to me and he was like, yeah, sure. You know, we're not going to just share you all our deep innermost secrets, but let's have a talk and let's chat. So we got on a call with him with his CEO at the time. And the guys were amazingly helpful. They were really, really transparent. we were going to work with them, all kinds of stuff. And then, this just didn't work out. Things got busy, and I think they've got quite a few other projects on the go. And obviously, it was quite a challenging time for them as well, launching the whole thing.
So let me back up just a bit. In these early phases, when you were approaching technology companies and you were educating yourself on technologies, there wasn't a whole lot out there. There was pretty much WaveGarden and Surfflakes, I believe, had prototypes.
Yeah, there were five major players at the time, but the first step was to jump to Nick Hounsfield. And then I realized, okay, we've got to really dig into all this technology and find out exactly what's on offer here. So you're right. There was WaveGarden. There was AWM, American Wave Machines, because
Waco was open around that time, yeah.
2018, around then, yeah. Kelly Slater was obviously open, but we didn't even try with them because we just felt that obviously wasn't a good commercial business model, having to wait 4 minutes for a wave. So we didn't even try and get hold of them. I did speak to a couple of people associated with Kelly Slater during the course of the podcast, but that was another story. And then Surflock, we spoke to them as well, and they were great, really helpful. And then Surfflakes were amazing. Aaron was incredible, was really helpful. And they were really organized because they were setting up, I think this was probably more like 2019, and they were setting up webinars as well to try and educate people on how to run wave pools. And they were sharing financial models as well, like WaveGarden did as well with us. So we took all this information and massive amount of knowledge. We were just, every single meeting we had, we were just sucking it all in and writing it down and built up this great big pile of intellectual property, really. And we put it all together and created our own financial modeling because we built a team, and we had about four of us on board here in Portugal. And things were going well. It was going well. I still had no idea how we were going to make any money out of it. I just thought, well, because it's a 30 million euro project, there's got to be some cash, right?
Well, I remember talking to you at the time, and you were looking for land, and you had found a piece of land that was perfect, and then that didn't work out. Then you found another piece of land. What maybe you can share with our listeners what you were looking for in a piece of land that would ensure a successful wave pool?
Yeah. Just, we kind of picked WaveGarden early on because the technology was really relevant. I think we had to choose exactly which technology we were going to go with. And we thought we would work with WaveGarden a lot because they just seemed to be the best. And they had all this, they had built pools by that stage. They had built their research and development facility in northern Spain. So we got on a plane up to Bilbao in the middle of winter. It was pouring with rain. And I think it always pours with rain up there. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Bilbao, it rains all the time.
Yeah. It was just this lush green valleys and stuff. And then hidden in one of these green valleys is this gorgeous emerald pool. And they'd just created the cove, the WaveGarden Cove, because if you remember, they had the lagoon before that. So we went up to WaveGarden and it was amazing. They rolled out the red carpet and they were amazing. Obviously, we had to pay for the privilege of being there. But they sort of analyzed our business plans and our financial models. And spoke to us, gave us really interesting information and great insights into the actual projects that they were working with around the world, and also relevant to Portuguese projects and what was going on there. So they were really helpful when it came to that. And we had a fantastic Basque lunch. It was really, really great. We went for a surf afterwards in the cove, which was great. And it was an amazing experience. And it really helped us as a team to, like another milestone we put in, like, okay, we're on our way. This gave us a lot more confidence, felt less like a bunch of imposters trying to do this. But then came what was going to be the largest hurdle of them all. And as you hinted at, is the land. Because surprisingly, generally, if you want to put a wave garden.
Wait, let me back you up really quick. With WaveGarden, you got into the pool. They, you said earlier companies had to vet people to see if you're legit or not. How did that process work with WaveGarden? I've heard people say, okay, they started out, they would have people pay a fee, but then people would just pay a fee to go surfing there when it was still a novelty. And then there's the larger commitment chunk of cash that comes up.
Yeah. I'm not sure what they're doing at this stage. They might have changed their philosophy because they were changing all the time because it was a new business and was growing fast. Mm-hmm. And obviously the level of interest was changing a lot. But at that stage, I think it was like a couple of grand. We had to go there for the day. Mm-hmm. You know, we obviously split it amongst our team and went along. And I think, you know, they do try to figure out if you're serious about it beforehand, because it's not just to come and play and surf kind of day. It's a business thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then obviously you need to, at that stage, you needed to buy a license for the country or for the region that you're planning to operate in before you could. And I can't remember the exact fee, but it was pretty substantial. I think it's like €250,000 or something, if I'm correct. So we never got to that stage, but there was quite interesting, because in Portugal there was a guy up in the north who said, I've bought a license from Wave God. Nobody else is allowed to do this, because he heard that we were doing it. Because that was another problem, is like we didn't know whether we could share the message or not, because there's so much, not cloak and dagger, but there's just a lot of, you know, you don't want to share it before the time's out, and then everyone sort of gets wild, and you get, you know, attract a lot of media attention, and you have to devote a lot of resources to try and respond to all that media. So there was a big concern of ours to try and keep it secret. But then on the flip side, if you don't keep it secret, you can't work with anybody. I mean, if you do keep it secret, then you can't work with anybody and grow the business. So it was a bit of a challenge that. And so anyway, there was this guy up in northern Portugal, and he's like, nah, I've got the Wave Garden thing, and no one else is allowed to do it, and you're not allowed to do it. And I was like, okay. So we spoke to Wave Garden, and they said, no, this has expired a long time ago. So it was fine. But since then, I'm not sure, but there's a party in Lisbon who are going to put a Wave Garden up in Seychelles near Lisbon, as I've read. I don't know any background information, but it sounds like that's going to be a Wave Garden project. You might know more about this than I do right now, Brian.
Yeah, there's also in Lisbon a Endless Surf project.
In Oviedo, a little bit further north.
Yeah, so that's, wave pools are coming to Portugal. Unfortunately, right. They're not your wave pools. And
thanks, Brian. Yeah, I'm a bit sad about that as well.
So what happened? You had the technology, you were looking for land. I kind of derailed you there on the conversation. What, tell us about land. How was that working or not?
Yeah, well, so obviously there's quite a few requirements. And especially with a wave garden pool, you need a 2.5 hectare slice of land, or like a patch of land, which is relatively level. You know, trying to have a 10-meter variance on either side, which is almost flat. And that's surprisingly tricky to find in Portugal, which is odd. Then you've got to have access to a market. You know, transport links are vital. You've got to have access to water, because, you know, you're going to put a lot of water in. I think if I remember correctly, it was about 150,000 cubic meters of water that you had to fill it up with. And then every year you would fill it up, which is nothing compared to a golf course, to water a golf course, but it's still a substantial amount of water that you need to have access to. And also access to energy. And then if you're doing green energy, you know, you have to have a lot of space for solar. It means more hectares on the ground. And so there's a lot of, and there's a lot more, you know, requirements and things that you need to do. So finding the land isn't as easy as one would think. It's quite tricky. So we analyzed 98 parcels of land around Portugal. And like I was saying to you all the time while we were doing it,
focus 98?
On 98, yeah. But superficially, so when I say 98, what we go to all the real estate agents out there, we try and find stuff ourselves. And then we also speaking to asset management companies about distressed assets and things, which is a really good way of doing it. Because the general real estate agent in the field doesn't know that much about, it's not there. You know, they're selling houses. They're not selling these large properties. And my main mission was to get what I call like a red line on Google Earth. So I needed to have a perimeter line that I could actually stick onto Google Earth and do like a desktop analysis. So we didn't have to be driving around the country, wasting a lot of time, a lot of money, evaluating every single little parcel. But most of these estate agents are like, no, man, you got to come and see it. You got to come and see it. And then they can, you know, try and persuade you to buy it. So I was like, I don't want to do that. So getting this red line was tough, and it was really, really hard. So eventually we managed to get 98 red lines all the way around Portugal. So my Google Earth is just filled with red lines. It's brilliant. And then we identified four or five that we spent a lot of time on. And they weren't all at once. We did them consequentially or sequentially. So we were looking at parcels of land, and each parcel of it obviously had a different aspect to it. And I remember one was south of Lisbon. It was actually in a beautiful location. And this lady who owned it, she was dying to get us to buy this thing. But obviously we had no money. So we wanted, we'll do the funding. That was step two, to do the funding, right? So we had to find, this is why it's so difficult, because you, I mean, look, if you've got 30 million bucks, it's much easier, you know, because you can show intent and you can do it. So we had to go and find a piece of land which we felt was suitable, and then we'd go and get the funds for it, and then we'd come back and buy it. So it was a very difficult sort of having all these balls up in there at one point.
Okay. And then,
So I'll tell you about this parcel of land just south of Lisbon. So she was trying to get us to buy this thing, and we spent quite a lot of time. We visited it twice, and you know, it's like a 2-hour drive getting up there, and you know, it's expensive, and petrol and tolls, and you know, it adds up. And this is, we're not making any money from this at the same time. So, you know, I'm trying to like make some cash on the side just to keep this thing going, which is tricky. And then we have a meeting with the local town council, and we meet with the president and the chief architect, which is takes time to get these meetings. So eventually we get them, and then they're like, okay, there's absolutely no ways you can do that project on that piece of land because of all these ecological constraints. And it was a really beautiful place right next to a river, and there's all these bird, you know, bird sanctuaries and stuff. So it's those kind of things that just come up and floor you. You can't do anything anywhere you want. So having spent like a couple of months on that piece of land, we're like, okay, cool, let's move on to the next one. And then there's, you know, three old ladies who own 200 hectares of land, massive portion of land, and they don't really know whether they want to sell it. One day they want to sell it. The next day they're like, oh, no, let's keep it as that's our heritage. And then you're like, there are all these crazy, crazy reasons why people, it's not just straightforward. They're not just on the market, you know what I mean? So yeah, it was a wild journey.
Wow. And within Portugal, are there any like cultural differences? I know for a while we have some roommates from Holland, or house guests from Holland staying with us, and they're wonderfully direct about things. Like, that is, you know, your dish, you clean it up kind of thing. And Portugal, when I've spent time in Portugal, people are very warm, people are very nice. Is that advantageous to what you were trying to do, or was it a little too indirect and you wanted
to? It's too indirect. Yeah, you have to beat around the bush a lot, and then, you know, ask how the cousins are and talk about food for half an hour before you can get to the real conversation. because I always laugh. There's every single dinner party we have. There's always a 35 to 45 minute conversation about food. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange. That's like here in France, when you arrive at someone's house, they invite you to show up at 7:00, you show up at 7:15. And that's just how it is. If you get giving your host 15 minutes to get ready, and you make up an excuse about traffic or whatever. And that's
Well, think about Portugal. I mean, I think about France, and Portugal is much more laid back than France. Things do move slowly here, and there's a lot of red tape, and things, take a lot of time. So it's tricky. And also, you know, being a foreigner in Portugal, I don't know whether it's just that I feel that way, but it's also, you know, if you know everybody, because there are a couple of guys that I mean, my Portuguese friends, they are so well connected in the town councils, and the government here runs everything, probably like they do in France as well. But local government's got its fingers in every single pie. And the people, you know, it's just a part of life. Government's a part of life. Whereas in where I'm from in South Africa, you know, nobody ever really considers the government. You know, you're entrepreneurial. You just do your stuff commercially, and the government doesn't come into play. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a much more sort of when the locals are much more well integrated, everybody's cousins, and you know, they've got some kind of family involved in the local authorities, so you can get stuff done and much more easily, because that's how you shortcut things here, obviously. It might have been a little bit more of a challenge with us being foreigners.
Yeah. Okay. So going through all these different properties, and were there a couple front runners? You know, where you were really excited, like, oh, this is going to go, this is going to happen.
Yeah, there were four or five that we were really keen on. And then the problem was that, you know, after every single time, there was a place in, up in Ericeira as well, which is just north of Lisbon, which is the surf capital of Portugal. And I'm sure a lot of the people listening will have heard of Ericeira. It's a world surf reserve. We actually looked at two parcels of land there, one right in the beginning. These guys wanted to turn it into a football field. And we said, no, let's rather not. Let's make a surf pool here. And the mayor was excited about it. And then it was quite strange because the mayor at the time, he came along and said, yeah, I'd love to support you. And then we went back to him 2 months later and he said, no, I'm sorry, I can't support you. And I was like, why? And we were a bit nervous and we weren't going to, you know, because this guy's like the president, you know, the president of a commune. We're not going to question this guy. So we're just like, okay, well. And that's another reason that we failed is because we didn't have the experience. We didn't have finance behind us. We didn't have the power to walk in and say, look, man, you know, and the confidence. So we're going to do this. And we know because we've done it before. So, for example, obviously wave pools were so new, nobody had done them before. But if you've got a golf course development or some other kind of leisure development behind you, you know, you'll have much more confidence and I think people will take you much more seriously.
So what would happen between this, like say you did find the land and it was perfect and you needed to act on it, what would have to happen in order for you to secure that? It sounds like you'd have to chase the funding at that point and the funding would have to come through pretty quick in order to make everything happen.
Yeah, so we'd try and get an agreement on the land and say, look, reserve it for us. We just give us some time and we're going to go out and do the funding. And yeah, the funding, for all we'd heard, it was actually going to be a lot easier than the land. But I know it was still going to be an incredibly difficult process. But it, actually having the land or having the agreement of the land does help the funding process, obviously, because you can't do it without that. You can't go to an investor and say, okay, we've got a dream to make a wave pool. We don't know where we're going to put it, but just give us $30 million. So what was going to happen after we'd negotiated with the land and got some written confirmations of the land and deeds and everything, we would go on a roadshow and go to New York, go to London and speak to all the major players around the world that were dealing with funding wave pools. Because obviously I'd met quite a lot of these people through your wonderful podcast. So we had a list of people already lined up that we were going to think. And some people were sort of semi-interested, but they were obviously waiting and seeing because I think a lot of guys were like, are these guys for real or not? Can they get the land? So that was the next step. That was going to be the next step, our sort of investment roadshow. And I know after chatting to Nick Hounsfield, he said that was an unbelievably difficult time, just trying knocking on doors. I think he said he got 250 rejections or something. I can't remember.
Wow, 250. Wow.
I think so, yeah. I can stand corrected. It was a long time ago when I was doing the podcast. But that was obviously going to be a tremendously difficult time as well. And what was difficult for me was at one stage, eventually, after the fourth or fifth rejection on the land or it had fallen apart, I was like, I can't see how we're going to get any money out of this unless we have funders come in and just pay us a salary and then it's just going to be like a job. We obviously wanted a slice of the whole pool as well. And that was going to be getting increasingly difficult to secure. Because obviously if you put money in, you can get money out. But you know what I mean?
No, I've heard that where projects say it's very difficult to make it happen, find the land, find the technology, brand it, and then still have profit for all your work.
Yeah.
After that.
And things are changing all the time.
Yeah.
Say again.
Yeah. Wow. So,
I mean, the technology is changing all the time. The lands, the land process is changing all the time. Sometimes the rules of engagement here in Portugal are changing all the time as well. You know, like what land you can buy and what, they sort of redeclare different rules every year regarding urban land and rural land and ecological land. So that's moving. So everything is changing, especially, and this takes a long time. So it's difficult.
And so during that was there any point where you were like, what was the closest you were?
Yeah, I'm trying to recall. I think there were some really high moments sometimes. There was a particular, we were working with a property developer down here in the Algarve. He was a fantastic guy and he really believed in us. So that was a high point as well when he said, okay, cool, I'm going to help you guys out. And he had found a lot of parcels of land through, basically what had happened was a big company in Portugal, a big bank had gone bankrupt due to the great financial crash in 2010, and also due to a little bit of mismanagement and a lot of illegal activity and embezzlement. So there are these three tranches of properties that were released because they were all bad debts, basically, right? So they've been released onto the market, and they were 10 cents on the dollar. So they were literally going, there was a piece of land that was going for something like 300,000 euros for this massive 100-hectare golf course. And that was unbelievably cheap, really was. And we were very excited about this, and it was looking to be pretty good because then we got this very experienced property developer helping us as well. So things were all looking good, and then somebody else swooped in and bought it because it was such a good deal. And they obviously knew the local, you know, the local people up in the area where it was taking place, and they just switched in underneath and just stole it out from underneath our feet. So that was probably the closest we'd got, I think, if you look at it. And then there was another point where the same lady that was trying to sell us that piece of land, the ecological land that wouldn't have been suitable, she came along. I was actually I don't know. This wasn't close. This is just a funny story along the way, because the next thing we saw about a year later was headline news. Ah, this new wave garden is going forth in place 80 kilometers out of Lisbon. And it was the same lady, and she knew an architect, and she'd just taken, she'd never heard of a wave pool before in her life, right? But we had been all naive and stuff. We told her about it, yeah, which is stupid, right? And so she was like, I can do this. And she got in touch with Wave Garden, and she's like, okay, cool. And obviously Wave Garden are not, you know, I mean, they're just trying to sell wave pools, which is fair enough, you know what I mean? So Wave Garden helped her a bit, and as far as I would imagine, like they would have helped us. And the next thing is that she's got this project and it's been approved by the local town council to be able to create this wave pool. And so we were like, oh man, how can she do that? It's just so horrible and it's not right. But you know, at the end of the day, it wasn't a very good situation. It wasn't a very, very good location. And nothing's happened with it since. So there's interesting stories. Lots of fun stuff going on underneath the covers there.
So the million-dollar question, do you still have feelers out for wave pool today in 2024?
I just don't have the energy, man.
Okay.
No, but we do have one feeler out. There is one part. I mean, like, if somebody came to us today and said, look, do you guys want to carry on? There's a really nice opportunity right over here. Are you keen? I think we'd probably look at it very closely, and because it's such a, we've done so much work, we've amassed so much information, you know, we've got so many contacts in the space, it would be warming them all up again and getting back on board. But I would have to have a very, very clear financial plan ahead, because one of the reasons I stopped doing it as well is because I have a YouTube channel about people relocating to Portugal, and that just jumped up. And it popped, went crazy, and it was really exciting. So I built a business around that, and that takes up a lot of my time. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting, and it keeps me happy.
So that's good. You transitioned from one to the other quite smoothly.
But I'm still at the back of my mind. I'd love to give these guys a call in Portugal, because there's two, as we were talking about earlier, there's two wave pools under construction or under development at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to go and make a few videos with those guys and see if they were up for a bit of a collaboration with media, because it's just something that's really close to my heart. And I love wave pools. I think it's so incredible.
Yeah, you really do. And that comes through in everything you would do, all the content you would produce for us. And it's funny, there are few, you need to have a second convention, like just a gathering of surf park nerds, of wave pool nerds, people who just love the idea of surfing in an artificial environment and wave riding. You know, custom-made waves.
Yeah. It feels like it's getting quite expensive now, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, if you look at the price of wave pools around, is it worthwhile?
To build one or surf one?
Surf one.
Oh no, it's totally doable. We went to the Wave in Bristol in September, and they have this great incentive. You surf there three times, and you get to sign up for their community, which grants you 50% off your second session of the day. And compared to other locations, they're really reasonable. I mean, I think a lot of sessions are between 40 and 55 pounds, depending on the skill level. And the dollar or euro to pound is pretty strong right now. So it's, you know, it's doable. You can, for just a little over, you know, $100, if you plan it right, you can get three sessions in one day.
Yeah, I mean, I just spent a Sunday morning surfing in mush down here on the Algarve coast. And I was like thinking about 2 hours of that versus 1 hour in a wave pool with crystal clear, perfect peeling waves.
Yeah.
It's a massive difference, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. We've but then when the surf is good and the ocean's firing, it's like there's nothing better.
Sure.
So if I can ask you to boil it down, a lot of our listeners, you know, are involved in the space and want to make something happen. Can you give us Nick Robinson's top five or top three advice? Pieces of wisdom to help people with their project.
Yeah, sure. I think obviously, you know, the obvious thing is to do as much research as you possibly can, and not just about wave pools, about everything, about, you know, what kind of cabins to put in there, what kind of, you know, extras. And we researched everything. And then we just tried to decide what to put in the wave pool. And we were going to put in like an artificial white water rafting session, and because, you know, they get these incredible things. We had long meetings all about this and how much power it took, and we got to learn every single aspect of it. So there's a hell of a lot to learn, you know, just about sand and where to find the sand for the beaches and things like that, and how we're going to get it. And so research obviously is paramount to success. And I think definitely if you're not a property developer yourself, partner up with somebody who's really, really good at that and got a lot of experience in large leisure property developments, because it's a very different ballgame to just, you know, home real estate. So it's a next level development. And I think, yeah, partnering up with a great team is right. And obviously get your finances in order. And I mean, not finances in order, but get great financial plans. And when I was doing it, the tech companies are great. I mean, they put together a lot of great financial plans. And you've got, you know, you can't just copy and paste theirs. You've got to adapt it to your own environment and do some serious research, get out there and do a lot of research. So yeah, essentially it's a research game. And then I don't know how, but you've got to figure out how you're going to keep yourself, you know, if you've got a lot of money and you can afford not to work for 3 or 4 years, that's great. And even longer, I would imagine. It's a long game. It really is a long game. And you just look at some of the projects out now. I think Scotland's under construction right now, but he's been doing it. Andy's been doing it for years.
Yeah.
And he'll get through because he's, you know, he's probably what, I don't know, how far is he? Is he?
They're scheduled to open in September.
Fantastic. Yeah. Because I remember chatting to him, and he's fantastic guy, really amazing. And I just wish all these guys the best of luck, because they're such a hard job. It really is. And I don't know how Nick Hounsfield did it, but it was incredible.
Now, it's interesting because talking to people in the space, and it is like everyone says, oh, yeah, it's hard work. But I don't think anyone realizes just how much hard work, how much time, how much research needs to go into it. And part of that's because it's brand new. It's being invented as you're doing it, figuring out. But at the same time, it's kind of challenging and addictive because you're making things up, you know, on the fly. You're making pieces work, making things fit together. It happens. It's really exciting. I think
it is. It's fun as well. And it's really fun doing it and fun meeting all these incredible people while you're doing it. And it's fun and exciting. Yeah. I think if you can nail all those pieces and work out how you're going to make money from it and keep yourself going, because, you know, you've got to survive. You can't just, not earn money for like 4 years.
Nope. What project really excites you?
Well, I think the two ones in Portugal, I don't really know much about them because I haven't been really following the space for about a year. I'm really excited about these because obviously I can surf them. I'd love to – actually, I really want to go and surf a city wave because those things look awesome. Have you surfed one?
So, yeah, City Wave is – and all the other ones, Unit, Kaana Wave, Epic Surf, they're all the rapid-style wave where there's this band across where you keep your energy and your speed and your flow, and it's incredibly different to surfing. So talking to the instructors and lifeguards at Waikai in Hawaii, they were saying how people who haven't surfed before do it much better than surfers. Because it's a lot of it's non-intuitive. And then there are amazing people who can do both, like Yanina Zeltzer and Valeska Schneider, who are able to surf ocean waves and standing waves.
But I'd imagine there's a massive difference between a flow rider and a city wave because of the deepness of it.
Yeah.
And you just get a much better sensation. Because I've done a flow rider here in the Algarve, and it just was like... It's completely dissimilar to surfing.
Yeah, it's a sheet wave. So it's just, as Tom Lochtefeld said, it's the taking the top 1% of a wave and putting it in a tank. So So we'll definitely see you when the Lisbon projects open, the Portuguese wave.
There are no dates, are there?
It's like 26, I believe. I'll have to... No, actually, I shouldn't say anything because I don't know. But I think it's around that time. Most of the pattern now is someone announces it, and then it's usually construction starts, and then within 18 months to 2.5 years after that, it goes. But we're going to see 10 to 12 wave pools open this year, Nick.
Wow. That'd be great because it felt like there was a bit of a pause just after COVID.
Yeah, after COVID and then the rising interest rates and inflation, that just kind of... slowed everything down. Supply chain issues were a huge thing as well for construction. So yeah, a lot going on, but people are still building them. They're still popping up.
Oh, it's going to be exciting when there's a wave pool in every corner. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, right on. Thank you so much for taking time out and joining us, Nick. And it's always great to speak with you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's lovely to chat to you as well, Brian, and thanks so much for the opportunity. It really is awesome. And thanks for all those episodes that I could do for you at Waypool Mag. That was fantastic fun.
That was great. Thank you for getting a podcast to happen on Waypool Mag, which has become incredibly successful. And a lot of people tune in and listen to it because it's information you can't readily find everywhere. And that's... a lot of people share the similar desires and experience that, you know, you've expressed here. So thank you for making that happen.
You're welcome.
Okay. Although I would love to have your accent and voice. I've got this like whiny Californian accent going, not as bad as Chris Cote, but kind of close to it. And you just have this wonderful
what
smooth...
does Chris Cote say about that when he listens to your podcast?
I don't know. We're going to find out. Chris.
I think I did actually ask him to come onto the podcast once. And it's like,
oh, he's great. He's been like, yeah, let's do it. And then disappears. And like, but that's the surf world. I think everyone kind of does that.
Yeah. Ben Gravy was the same. I was like, come on, Ben, let's get on it.
And he was like, yeah, we're going to do it. Silence.
Listen, well, best of luck, and it's going well. I'm sure it's wonderful.
Okay, right on. Thanks so much, Nick.
All right, bye.